Morning. Normally, when Ian rings up and says, are you free to preach or speak or whatever you want to call it on Sunday, the whatever, I have to say my heart jumps because I just love being able to serve God. And so he rang me a little while ago and he said, are you going away over the holiday? I went, no. He said, oh, good. I've got a date for you. So I said, okay. So he gave me the date. And when I went to look in my diary, lo and behold, I'd had an email about 15 minutes before Ian rang offering me 3 days' work on the weekend when he was asking me to speak. And I'd already sent an email back saying, yes, please, I'll take the 3 days' work. So I got back to Ian, I said, sorry, but I've booked, you know, weekend's work for that date. Oh, it's all right, he said. There's a couple of people who've already got back to me and they need to swap. So I said, okay, well, you do the swap and I'll go and work that weekend. About an hour later, I got another email saying, that job's been cancelled, we don't need you that weekend. And I thought, oh, what's that mean? And then Ian texted me the passage for today. And my heart sank. Absolutely went through the floor. And it wasn't much better when I met with Ian for a coffee and we sat down to talk about what, as a sort of on the teaching team as he is, to say, what did the teaching team think was going to come out of this passage? And Ian's answer was, I can't remember, but I'm really pleased it's not me doing it. Now, you can imagine, I really felt buoyed up by this. And then one day this week, Jill said to me, how's your prep going? I went, not very well. And being married to a spiritual wife, she said, well, that's because you're not praying hard enough or long enough. Real encouragement. And then I get a text from Mike saying, we're not quite sure where the service is going this Sunday morning. Perhaps we ought to have a chat. Well, praise the Lord. By the time I'd talked to Mike, and Mike had said, where do you think you're going? I actually got off the phone thinking, yeah, I think we've got somewhere that this is going, and it seemed to tie in with what Mike was saying. So I'm just trusting that you'll find some benefit from some of the things I hope to bring out of this passage. It's one of those passages, you know, the whole story of Joseph that we've looked at have been positive after positive after positive. And today we get to a bit of a negative. And so, our subject is Joseph, how to prosper in adversity. And the first thing I want to say about that is that if we're struggling with something, if we are having problems, then we should try and look on it as a positive that we can learn from. Not always easy when we're in the midst of a problem, but from experience, there are things that we can learn and we can benefit from as we go through life. So we've got three sections, and the first one I've called Joseph's Provision, Making Provision and Planning for the Future. Before we get to the chapter we're looking at, chapter 47, I just want to backtrack to a bit that in chapter 45, verse 18, when Joseph has gone and told Pharaoh about the plight of his family, and Pharaoh says, bring your father and your families back to me. I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you can enjoy the fat of the land. And then in chapter 46, which we haven't looked at, we have a whole list of the whole of the tribe of Jacob that comes to live in Egypt. And in 46:28, we're told that they're sent to a specific area of Egypt called Goshen. And this area is in the Nile Delta, right down towards the Mediterranean. It's one of the most fertile parts of Egypt now, and it was then. And so Pharaoh didn't tuck them off into a back corner of the desert and forget about them. In honouring Joseph, he actually provided for the family to go to the best part of Egypt to live. And then we have this bit in 46 which is Joseph planning and organising things. Because he actually says to them, what's going to happen is you're going to get called to meet Pharaoh. And he's going to ask you what you do for a living. And I want you to tell him that you're shepherds, you're herdsmen, you're skilled with animals, and that is how you've always made your living. Because in Egypt, shepherds were frowned upon. People didn't want to be shepherds particularly. And so it was a bit of a demeaning job as far as the Egyptians were concerned. So that was what was going to happen. So now we come to chapter 47. And Joseph's planning comes to fulfilment here. In the first few verses, we actually see being acted out the story that he's already told his brothers of exactly what would happen. Pharaoh asked what their skills were. They replied, we're shepherds, we're herdsmen, we look after animals. And Pharaoh said, then you will take care of my flocks and my herds. So in one move, Joseph has, in a way, manipulated Pharaoh, and he has provided somewhere fertile for the family to live and reside. He's provided work for them. He's provided income. And you could actually say that was a bit of advanced planning par excellence on Joseph's part. He couldn't have really done it much better. But a cynic may say, Joseph had done all this out of greed, if you like, for his family, out of a passion for his family. But he was just simply providing for his family as the best way that he could. Because we heard in previous weeks that he put everything that had happened to him, from the time he was sold by his brothers, to the time he was put in jail, to the time he was translating Pharaoh's dreams, that Joseph kept giving the honour back to God. And he said to his brothers, you know, you didn't really have a choice about selling me into slavery. It was part of God's plan to provide for this time now. So out of this, I think there are three things. I've tried to try and find some practicalities for us as we look at this passage. And first of all, Joseph made the best of his abilities that he had from God. When he became Pharaoh's number one man, he didn't lord it over people. He looked after people. He served people. He used the gifts that God had given him. And so for us, I think we need to be aware of what God has given us in gifts, in abilities, in love, in compassion, and that we're actually prepared to share them with one another. To be aware of the people's needs. To be prepared to act in a helping hand where we can, either practically, financially, but also spiritually, in praying for people, into their situation, into their needs. And to always think sometimes that no matter how bad our life is, there's likely to be somebody who's actually a lot worse off. And sometimes when we're in adversity, we focus in on ourselves. We fail to see what's going on around us because we're so concerned about our own situation. But Joseph provided for the family in that special way. The second part we get is the famine. Now you remember again from previous weeks that Pharaoh had this dream that there was going to be 7 years where the cattle are fat and the grain is growing strong, and then seven more hungry cows come along and hungry corn eats the good corn. And Joseph gives him this translation that it means there's going to be 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. And you think, well, that was really great that they had the prior notice that they got 7 years to do something about it. For many of us, when the famine of our life arrives, whatever it may be, it happens almost instantly sometimes, and we haven't had time to plan. But this is the difficult part of this passage, I thought, because the way that Joseph deals with the Egyptians. In verses 13 and 14, they come to him and they say, "We're starving. We need food." And during the seven good years, Joseph had built storehouses and barns, and he had stockpiled food for the future. And so people came asking for food. And you might think, well, you know, as a benevolent leader serving Pharaoh, if Pharaoh's people are in need, he would just give them food. But he doesn't. He actually says to them, "Come and buy food. Bring your money. Pay for it in hard cash." And we see that that's what they do. The people bring their money, and Joseph effectively takes it all and gives them food. Verses 15 and 17, we assume it chronologically and time-wise, it doesn't tell us it's a year later or whatever, but it appears to be about a year later. We read that the people again came to Joseph saying, "All of the food we bought has gone. We're starving again. But we haven't got any money because you've got it all." And Joseph said, "Well, in that case, you can bring all your livestock, your sheep, your goats, your cattle, and you can buy food with those." And you think, okay, well, that's fine. So suddenly, what's Pharaoh going to do with all these sheep, goats and cattle? He's going to give them to Joseph's brothers to look after, because they're not just going to leave them and do nothing with them. And then we get to verse 18 to 21, where the people come again, saying, "We're starving. Please give us some food, Joseph." He's got their money. He's got their cattle, their sheep, their goats. And he says, "Well, then you can give me your land. You can give up your land, your birthright, and you can pay that to Pharaoh for food." And the people are so starving, that's what they do. They give it all up. And in certain versions, it says they moved into the cities, that Joseph moved them into the cities. And we see in our modern society, in many developing countries, the people who lived and farmed the land have been migrating into cities. And that breaks their link to that land that has probably been in their families for generations. And when we first read this, we think, well, yeah, Joseph, you know, he wasn't the goody-goody two-shoes that we've sort of been led to believe in previous weeks, where he's doing God's will, he's serving God, he's putting, you know, giving all the glory to God. Here he is, taking their money, their livestock, and their land. I mean, you know, I read this and I thought, what was Joseph thinking about? Why didn't he give them some food? Why didn't he sell them it at a subsidised rate? You know, Julian and Caroline buy food for the starving and the hungry people in Malawi that they're supporting, but they don't make a profit on it. They actually sell it at a subsidised rate to help people survive through a famine in that situation. And then we have to think, well, what happened when Joseph translated the dreams of Pharaoh? I'm sure he didn't just take Pharaoh into a little side room and say, "This is what your dream means, and I'm going to build the storehouses and we're going to stockpile grain for your royal household." It must have been, you know, given out and communicated to the whole of Egypt. And the suspicion then is that, of course, the people didn't necessarily heed what was being said and didn't stockpile enough, didn't put enough food aside, because eventually, as we've just heard, they had to come to Joseph begging for food, and give it everything they had. But the important thing to remember here is that Joseph wasn't doing this for himself. He didn't take the money. He didn't take the livestock or the land. It all went to Pharaoh. And so at this time, Joseph's brothers were prospering, the family were prospering, because they were looking after these animals for Pharaoh. They had food, and we're told that Joseph provided food for his family as well. But the interesting thing is that Joseph didn't actually make the Egyptians slaves by taking their goods. They were still free people. They weren't in bondage to Pharaoh. And later on in verse 23 to 26, we read that as the famine is coming to an end, he gives them seed for food and to plant so that they can start to support themselves again. And he brings in this series of tithing to Pharaoh, where they have to give a 20th or a 5th of what they produce to Pharaoh, and they get to keep the rest for their labours. So they weren't into slavery. Joseph didn't get that. He actually left them as free people. And for some of us, we can take our freedom too easily. We don't think what our freedom actually costs, what it's worth, what it would mean if we were no longer free people. And, you know, the New Testament says that even slaves who turn to Jesus are free. They may be in slavery, but they are free. And that's what we are. We are free people under God's grace. But what does that mean to us about us and our lives here today in Warwick, Leamington, wherever we reside? I think that, you know, we can take from here that we need to prepare. You know, if we find ourselves in a time of plenty where we've got promotion or we've got a bonus or life is just running along at a nice steady pace and everything's, you know, okay, we should be setting aside some of our income, some of our time, some of what God provides in a material way. Because that's our responsibility. It might be a little. It may be that God has blessed us with jobs that give us a huge salary. But we can all be assured that we're going to have some hiccups in our lives. We're going to have times when we have a spate of adversity. It may not be financial. It can come in many other ways, through illness, through loss of job, through relationship breakdowns. There can be all kinds of things that can affect our lives. And some people will say, well, storing up money and possessions and wealth is not biblical. But in the New Testament, Jesus said, sell all you have and give it to the poor. But also, we're called upon, if our reason for storing up wealth and possessions is for ourselves, and that becomes the focus of our life, of how big our investment portfolio is, how big our pension pot is, how big our bank account is, how many exotic holidays we can go on. If that becomes our life, which, let's face it, for some people we probably know that is their reason for doing what they do, then that is wrong. But if we can turn a biblical perspective onto this, if we look upon the things that we store up as being God's, then we have to be prepared to give them back to God as and when he calls upon them. And so we have to be prepared to be aware of brothers and sisters' needs. At certain times, it can be a practical help, giving a lift going and helping with a chore, doing the gardening. At other times, it can be a case of giving them some money. And if you've got some money and you want to give it to somebody, that can be really great. But you also have to be aware of how that other person then feels. A long time ago, before we turned around, we were facing that way. And my business was, I was making furniture and nobody really wanted to pay me enough for the furniture I was making. And Jill, bless her, was basically keeping our family of four on £30 a week if she was lucky. And we didn't qualify for benefits or anything else. And we sat here one Sunday morning and Graham Harvey, who some of you know, walked in and gave me a white envelope. And I tucked it in my Bible. And halfway through the service, Jill, being the inquisitive one she is, kept saying, "What was that? What was that?" And I said, "Oh, it's probably the minutes of the deacon's meeting or something." And she kept saying, "No, what was that?" I opened the envelope towards the end of the service and there was £250 in cash. And I went to Graham and I said, "What's this for?" And he said, "God's provided it for you and Jill." And I said, "Where from?" And he said, "Well, the cash machine outside Sainsbury's, practically." But someone came and felt prompted as they walked from the car park past the cash machine that they wanted to give Jill and I some money. Did we spend it? No. We took it home. We put it on the top shelf of the dresser in our dining room. And it sat there for a long time. Because we just didn't feel it was right to spend it. You know, sometimes there's two sides to when we give. We can give in love and compassion and care for someone, but we also have to understand how that person feels. And for some of us, we take it, we find it very hard to receive love, compassion and care. And for some of us blokes, let's add in, we're pretty proud. And we don't want to think we can't provide for our families in whatever way it may be. And so we always have to bear that in mind. But I would say that the encouragement is that we need to have resources. God gives us a wealth of resources. It's not all financial. Some of us have practical skills, some of us have accounting skills, some of us have management skills, all kinds of things that we can share with one another and support one another. And so we have to think about how we do that. But above all, we have to be aware that what we have actually belongs to God. And it's what we do with it. And the title says, How to Prosper in Adversity. And I would say that sometimes, if we're struggling with a situation, we need to look for the blessings that God is giving us. Last 18 months or so, as many of you know, I had problems at work. And yet, throughout all of that, I can say that I can look back and actually see some incredible blessings where I have prospered. Not financially, because prospering isn't always about financial gain. I have prospered in many ways. Because I worked long hours and I was always away, when Olivia was born, the only person she knew was Grandma. And if we went to visit, you could almost see her looking at her going, "Oh, who's this funny bloke with Grandma?" Now, you might think that's quite appropriate, you know, but it meant that she didn't know who I was. Because I wasn't at work, I got to know my granddaughter. Amazing blessing. And I prospered enormously from that. I got the opportunity to come and help at Little Fishes on a Monday morning. It was great. You know, I always thought, you know, ladies did Little Fishes. But it was brilliant. I loved it. And I can't wait for the next term to start, because I've told Liz I'm going back, you know. I'll try and manage my work schedule that Monday mornings are free. But, you know, it was a real blessing to go and do something like that. And as you all know, I love fishing. And I got the opportunity to become a water bailiff for the local angling club because the bailiff was taken poorly. I met some lovely characters. And I can honestly say I've got some friends now who aren't Christians. You know? How often do we all say, well, I don't know, I've got any friends, they're all in church. You know, I've prospered from that time by actually having some friends now who don't come to church. They're not Christians. You know, I have an opportunity to spend some time with them and hopefully, as time goes on, share with them about my faith. But the other thing that we've benefited from is your love, your prayer support, your time, your willingness to listen as I ramble on for ages about what's gone on. You know, these have all been blessings and encouragements in a time of adversity, as it says there. So I'd encourage us to all store up for the future, but not just money. We need to store up spiritual things, treasures in heaven, to remember the times when God has provided for us, when prayers have been answered, when we've received blessings from God through his people. This is a spiritual wealth. And I can assure you, when things go wrong, that spiritual wealth that you build up is what will sustain you. Because in the dark times, you can remember when God dealt with things in your life, when God encouraged you, when God provided for you, when God answered prayers that you've prayed for other people as well as yourself. And then we come to the final part in verses 27 to 31, the promise. I've called this the promise. The Israelites have settled, as we know, in Goshen. They're in a great land of milk and honey almost for them. They're prospering, they're buying land, they're getting bigger as a tribe, a nation. And Jacob is getting very old. And Jacob calls Joseph to him. And he says to Joseph, don't allow me to be buried in Egypt. When I die, I want you to bury me with my forefathers. And that, for him, was vitally important. Because for Jacob, his family, his history as the chosen people of God was crucial. He wanted to be in his homeland with his family. What about us? We have all to face death. Are we going to worry about where we're going to be buried? What's going to happen to our ashes if we die? You know, had a conversation with my mom, and as many of you know, my mom is not quite as old as Jacob, but she's getting there, bless her. She'll be 106 in December. And the children went to see her this week and said, Nanny hasn't changed at all. You know, and I had a conversation with her saying, what do you want to, you know, what happens when you die, Mum? What do you want to do? And she said, when you've cremated me, you can take me up to the back of the church where I go up onto the sea bank and you can spread my ashes to the winds because it doesn't matter where they are. But for Jacob, it was vitally important. But for us, we have an advantage over Jacob, that we live in a post-New Testament time. We know that we have a promise for the future that was given through Jesus' death on the cross, his resurrection, and the fact that he now reigns alongside his Father in heaven. This is a promise of eternal life. It can't be bought. We can't earn it. It's a supreme gift from God to all of those who believe and accept Jesus as their Saviour. So we are rich in so many things. And that promise is probably one of the greatest riches we can ever have, because it is that gift from God. And so I'd encourage us all to do that, to accept that promise, to cherish it, but also to be open to God's guiding us through our lives, through the good times, through the hard times, but always be looking to God to be the one to provide, to guide us and to help us. And I keep being challenged more and more that the way that God does that is through our prayers. We can never pray enough. As Jules has said, you're obviously not praying hard enough or praying enough. You know, and I find that is a challenge to us about lots of things. And so, as we've said week after week now, we have a prayer ministry team. Two people will be in the corner. Feel free to go and pray. I have to say, I'm disappointed, frustrated that we don't see more people coming for prayer. And I don't mean that in a critical way or condemning, don't get me wrong. But I just feel so challenged that we have this great gift from God and we don't use it for whatever reason. Because we tend to be self-sufficient, we tend to be strong, we tend to rely on ourselves, when in fact we can be relying more and more on God. So,
thanks, John.